y'all. This is Jake Cole from Not Just Movies. Come on in and sit a spell. We're going to talk about Christian Bale, AI, and some sort of girly Stand By Me.
Oh my God. That was awesome. This is Allison from nerdvampire.wordpress.com, and you are listening to Some Cast It Hot, Episode 10, where we will be discussing performances of child actors. And Alex will not be able to join us because she's in Aruba right now, so you know what? We're all jealous, actually, and you should not feel bad for her for not being on this episode. But we have a lovely guest in Mr. Jake Cole.
So,
yay! So, Jake, do
you want... That's a stunning introduction. Yeah. I'm Jake. I run Not Just Movies at armchairc.blogspot.com. I've been running it for about 2.5 years. I do it in between classes at Auburn University in Alabama, which is one of the worst places on Earth. It's the it's just a cultural dead zone. Like, take Toronto and just go the opposite, and that's Auburn.
Hey, Toronto's not that great.
I mean, compared to where I am, though, there's a single theater.
Are you serious?
Yep, and it's a college town, too. I don't understand.
Wait, you mean like a single repertory theater or just like a single theater in general?
Just like just a single movie theater that basically plays like Twilight movies all the time.
Wow.
It's so much fun.
Wow. Allison, like how big of a town do you live in? I've never asked you that.
Chapel Hill isn't really big, but we kind of combined it with the local hippie town. So, and we're close by to the nearest metropolitan areas in North Carolina, so that's Raleigh and Durham, basically.
Jake, anything else before we start? To let the listeners know more about you.
God, there's just so little there. Should I talk about how, like, I came across Some Cast It Hot?
Sure.
Alright. I don't know when I can't remember when I joined LAM, but there have been a couple of sites I'd read, and I think the only place I discovered through LAM that I really liked was Alex's site. And then from there, I think I saw Sasha posting on hers, or I don't know how I found you, but then I saw you mention Some Cast It Hot, and I listened to the first one, and that's how I found Caitlin and Allison, and I just became a fan. The first one I heard, I liked, and I usually hate movie podcasts, so.
What was our first episode, Allison? I don't even remember.
That was the episode where we tried to figure out what we were going to do for the rest of the time, so we weren't really talking about anything.
It was kind of scattershot, but charmingly so.
Aww. Thank you.
So, Allison, do you want to introduce our awesome guest segment?
Okay. In order to get to know Jake, we are going to play Would You Rather, but movie-themed. Oh, TV show-themed. Right, Sasha?
Oh, and movie-themed.
And movie-themed, so it's both. Sasha, do you want to begin?
Okay. So, my first one is TV-themed. So, would you rather have Oscar Bluth from Arrested Development or Peter Griffin from Family Guy as your father?
Oscar Bluth, no question.
And why?
Oh, my God. Well, hey, I think mainly just because I hate Peter Griffin. But anything Arrested Development related, and I haven't watched Arrested Development in a while. It's been, I usually have like a monthly viewing, and I haven't had one in a while. So, I'm trying to think what specifically...
Maybe just because it's Jeffrey Tambor.
Well, yeah, that's as good a reason as they have. Also, I mean, he is loaded, even if all that money is technically not his.
Allison, do you have one?
I do. Jake, would you rather need a bigger boat, Jaws or realize the Jeeps are only remote controlled, Jurassic Park?
Oh, a bigger boat, definitely. Because at least with a tiny boat, you can flee. You can still get away. The remote control car, like, once you realize that the thing is just standing there and it's not moving and there's a T-Rex, like, you're dead.
Yeah, but then you're on a boat. There's, like, nowhere to go except for the water.
You have to take wreckage and swim back to land. You know how exhausting that would be?
I think Alice is just lazy.
I'm not that lazy. If I realized that the car was remote controlled, I would still have to, like, start booking it once I heard the T-Rex, and then hope he doesn't go for the wherever I'm hiding.
But at least they swim back when the shark is already dead. When they run back, like, everything's just still kind of there when they have to run. You can't take down a T-Rex, really.
That's true.
Okay, so let's say that you're going to die anyway. Would you rather your insides ripped out and eaten by a group of zombies, like David in Shaun of the Dead? Or would you rather be splattered with a church spire, like Tim Messenger from Hot Fuzz?
Splattered, it's quick death.
But that was pretty gruesome.
But, I mean, still, he didn't see it coming. He just went down. If I had to watch myself being eaten...
Yeah, very true. He wasn't, like, alive for a large section of that.
So, if you were in a mental hospital, would you rather be Teddy Daniels from DiCaprio's character from Shutter Island, or McMurphy, Jack Nicholson's character in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Oh, that's a good one.
For like a teasing kind of loosening up question, that makes me surprisingly thoughtful. I think I'd go with Teddy Daniels just because, I mean, compared to McMurphy, who's just kind of an asshole, like at least Teddy Daniels kind of has a reason to be there, and he wants to do something. I feel like McMurphy's just kind of there just to be there, and he's just making noise. And then finally, they just, like, cut out his brain. Which, I mean, that's the worst summary of all time. I don't know. Also, if I'm Teddy Daniels, I get to be Leonardo DiCaprio, so that's fun.
That's always a plus.
That's true. And you can hang out with Mark Ruffalo while you're in your delusions.
Oh, my God, Mark, I will do anything to hang out with Mark Ruffalo. I think they all, right? Like, I don't think anyone could not be friends with Mark Ruffalo.
I agree. You guys know he's on Twitter.
Like a pause. Yes.
No, I'm just thinking. I would love to be friends with Mark Ruffalo. I would love to be other things with Mark Ruffalo as well. But that's besides the point.
Well, moving on.
Okay.
Would you rather have Michael Scott or David Brent as your boss?
I think I'd rather have Michael Scott because I think he's just more lovable. David Brent. And he wants to be loved, but he's just too damn unlikable. Michael Scott is kind of, because he's American, so he's softened.
That's pretty good. I mean, I'd probably go with that.
I mean, I'd rather watch David Brent. I'd rather actually work for Michael Scott.
Allison, do you have an answer to that? I know it's for Jake, but I'm just interested.
I don't know. Michael Scott is lovable in a weird way.
I don't know. I find Michael harder to watch than David Brent.
Right, but would you want him to be your boss?
Well, if David Brent were my boss, then Martin Freeman would be my colleague, and I'm okay with that.
That's such a roundabout answer, though.
Oh, God. Do you guys want to talk about movies we've seen lately?
Sure. Yep.
Jake?
Recently, a blog I followed, the Sheila Variations, she held an Iranian film blogathon, so I kind of binged on Iranian movies for about a week and a half. A couple of them were, there's this film called A Moment of Innocence by, I don't know how to pronounce it, I think it's Mohsen Makhmobov, and it's basically, like, as a teenager, he was a revolutionary in, like, the Shah of Iran. And he wanted to get a gun to be a revolutionary, so he stabbed a police officer and went to jail for it. And then years down the road, the cop that he stabbed tracked him down and found him. And he basically has to be put in a movie. So the director made a movie kind of about why he stabbed the cop, and the cop like picks out who he wants to play his younger self, and the director picks out his younger self. And it's kind of like a meta movie. It's kind of like Charlie Kaufman-esque, but it's about like why this director did what he did. And it's surprisingly moving considering how like far out it is. And I mean, I really recommend it, even though you have to go to less than legal means to find it.
How long, how many movies was in this blog series that was running?
All in all, it was kind of short notice, so I think about 40 people contributed, or there were 40 entries. I watched about 4 in all, but I think overall, there were some overlaps. I think about 30, 35 movies were discussed.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't heard about this at all.
I can send you the link when we're done.
Sure. Allison, have you heard about this?
I've heard about it from Jake's Twitter, but not really from any other sources. And I've gone to a few of the reviews, too. But mostly, it's just interesting to me to pick Iran for, like, a nation-centric film blogathon, because you don't hear too much about them, but I know that they have a thriving film... Man, I'm falling over my words today. Yes, a film industry.
I was surprised, because I only saw my first Iranian film about maybe a year and a half ago, and since then it's one of my favorite, like, it's up there with anything out of Asia for me. Like, it's just, and they don't have any money, obviously, because it's a strict, I mean, half the movies they make are censored, but the movies they make are really unique, and I don't know, I just love to watch them. I think that they're deeper than the stuff we make.
Are most of the films, like, fairly recent, or have they had, like, a strong film industry for a while?
They've had a new wave that's been kind of going on for about 30 years, pretty much since the Ayatollah took over. I think that's when a lot of the cinema, I mean, there was cinema before that, but I think a lot of it's kind of come out of, its heyday was kind of the mid-90s, but it's kind of getting, a couple people are starting up now, so it's kind of recent compared to, like, American film history or anything like that, but it's not, like, brand new.
Allison, what have you seen?
Oh, the last movie I saw was Metropolitan, and it was directed by Whit Stillman or Will Stillman, W name something. have you guys seen it? It came out around 1990.
No, I have not.
I
haven't
seen it.
Okay. It's basically about preppies during winter break in New York. This one guy who happened to be at a dance for his school ends up in a group of these really highly rich but highly intelligent other group of students from other ritzy schools. And he keeps saying, oh, I don't believe in these parties. I'm a Fourier socialist. But he ends up becoming fairly close with them. And it just takes place maybe over 10 days. And in its summary, it's referred to as a comedy of manners. I wouldn't really call it that. It's maybe more of a dramedy. But you get, like, these weird, interesting side tangents from the characters about, like, their own culture. One decides that, you know, he's trying to defend bourgeoisie, and he's like, oh, I watched The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, and I was so ready for, like, a director who absolutely got, you know, they understood the bourgeoisie, and they're going to present it in a great light, and I was very disappointed when I found out that it was, you know, actually scathing towards the bourgeoisie, which was just so weird at the time.
What time period is it set in?
It's set contemporary, so it does take place in the 1990s, but the thing is, the cover looks like it's from the 1800s, because the girls are all in these big poofy white ball gowns, and the guys are all in black tuxes, and I had just come off from watching The Age of Innocence, so I thought, oh, well, this will make a good sort of double feature with that.
Yeah.
What's weird is it does, because they both end up talking about, like, the same things in weird ways, like certain hypocrisies and what is expected of the upper class. and how you're supposed to act in relationships. They make a commentary about how some of the girls have not had any relationships until college, really. And they don't like the European guy who just shows up randomly. And, you know, overall, it was funny. It's kind of interesting to see what actors pop up that you recognize. I think if you like Noah Baumbach, you would probably like this movie. It's in the same vein of just, like, intelligent people sitting around. Not a lot happens, but still fun to watch.
I just bought something by him, and I totally forget what it is.
Last Days at Disco?
No, no, I'm trying to find the DVD. this is great. Oh, Kicking and Screaming.
Right.
Oh, Baumbach. I'm in the other guy.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
There's an overlap with one of the actors between Kicking and Screaming and Metropolitan.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. If you ever watched Gilmore Girls, he was a character on there for, like, 2 seasons. He played Jason Stiles. I know you guys have not watched Gilmore Girls.
Actually, I have, but I don't remember who that is. Was he a love interest of any sort?
Yeah, he was Lorelai's boyfriend for a while.
Is he the one that wrote the stuff in the books? Like, the bad boy that read books?
No, that was Rory.
Oh, yeah, this was, that's the only one I remember.
This was the rich guy who was the partner of Richard in the business.
The blonde? Oh, I'm thinking of the wrong
person. You're thinking of...
person.
Yeah. But that doesn't matter. He, basically, this actor always gets picked to play, like, rich, intellectual, quick-witted guys. And he plays the same thing in Kicking and Screaming that he does in Metropolitan. Which it was funny for me, at least. And the same way he plays as Jason. But he's fun to watch. Sasha, do you want to tell us about your last movie?
Sure. I just watched Paul. I think it was like on Tuesday, but I haven't had enough time to actually watch anything else. But Paul, I think it's out already in England, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah? So it's the Simon Pegg and Nick Frost movie. They wrote and starred in it. And basically, the plot is that Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, they do their big nerd pilgrimage to the San Diego Comic-Con. And after the Comic-Con, they do a road trip on the extraterrestrial highway. And they do all the alien spots of interest, and they take their pictures there or whatever. And along the way, when they're outside of Area 51, they meet an alien played by Seth Rogen named Paul. And it's really just like a, I don't know, like a super bad meets space. I've mentioned this kind of comparison before, road trip. And it was, I had fun with it. It was enjoyable, but I think I walked into the theater thinking it would be the alien equivalent of, like, Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz. And so I was slightly disappointed. But everyone else seemed to really enjoy it.
Okay. I remember when Simon Pegg first talked about it, he made it sound a lot darker than it looks like in the trailers. I mean, your review is pretty much what I was afraid of when I saw the trailer. It just kind of looks like super bad with an alien.
Yeah, its tone is, like, it's not hard enough to, like, accept the gruesome deaths. Like, there are a couple more gruesome deaths. And then the rest of it's, like, it's very lighthearted funny. So its tone is a little muddled, but everyone seemed to enjoy themselves. And the second half is much better than the first. And Kristen Wiig. Which Kristen. One is it? Kristen?
Yeah.
She's in it, and she plays a Jesus-loving Cyclops, according to my friend. But she's quite funny in it. And Jeffrey Tambor is in it, but he's poorly used. And it was so disappointing. But yeah, I'll just wait for the next Edgar Wright movie.
Oh, hang on. I have a question. Did any of the side characters really stand out to you?
No.
Oh.
I'd say Kristen Wiig's character, but she really becomes, like, the fourth in their group. She's not really a side character. I thought Jane Lynch would steal the show in her cameo, but she barely says a word. But Jason Bateman's in it, and he plays like the straight man, secret agent, and he has a nice development in his storyline, which I had not expected, but I probably should have because it's probably very obvious, but I wasn't really paying attention.
So, shall we move on to our main discussion film, Empire of the Sun?
Do you have a summary?
Sort of.
Okay.
And I'll just go ahead and remind y'all, our theme tonight is going to be child actor performances. So this, in Empire of the Sun, the main character is played by a young Christian Bale. Does anyone remember what his name is?
Jim.
Yeah, Jim or Jamie.
Okay. Jim.
Jamie Graham?
Yeah.
Jim or Jamie is an English kid in Shanghai. He has rich parents, basically, so he's never really known any kind of hardship. And during World War II, the Japanese invade China. And he gets separated from his parents, and most of the movie is watching him try to survive, at first in Shanghai during the early days of the invasion, and then later on in a camp. Anyone want to start off the discussion?
Jake?
I guess the thing I love about it is just essentially everything about Christian Bale. I'm a pretty unabashed Christian Bale fan. Anyway, and this might be my favorite thing he's ever done. And I hate to pigeonhole him that early, but he's...
Oh, no, it's definitely his best work.
Like, he's so good in this, and because he basically has to play a kid, but also kind of an adult at the same time, because everything he sees in, like, these camps just destroys him. Like, he sees so much death, he sees starvation and all these things, and pretty much by the end of the film, he's just broken. And it's amazing to see, like, how he goes through that. It's as intense as something Bale has done with The Machinist or American Psycho. He's that intense at age 14, 12. I think he was 12 when he did the role.
I was kind of deliberating about earlier was picking my recommendation. And that's something I noticed was Steven Spielberg has the ability to get the best performances out of child actors, and he directed Empire of the Sun, and it's really obvious here because the movie, everything is shot from his perspective. So you're seeing things from a child's perspective that are horrifying, and it's able to see it, you know, you're able to see it with fresh eyes. Going back, when you see the reactions from Jim, then you get it's tremendous, really. Especially when there are so many movies about World War II out there. I don't know about y'all, but I've become a little bit numb to, like, especially if they're not well done. You see Empire of the Sun, and it's destroying. I don't want to say I became as destroyed as Jim, because I don't think anyone could unless you were put into that experience, but it was just so well done. And again, Christian Bale gives, like, an excellent performance even at age 12.
Yeah, I really agree with Allison about how there's just this childlike perspective, because it is all through Jim's eyes, and I thought Steven Spielberg did a really, really good job with that. You know, in one of the opening scenes when they're at the party, the elaborate costume party, where he stumbles across that skeleton of the plane, and there's, like, so much devotion and awe about this silly plane. It's been there forever, it seems like. And then he's playing with a toy plane. And he's trying to shoot that one down with the skeleton of the old plane. I love that because he doesn't really know what war's about because he is so so sheltered. And this is kind of his like first encounter with the Japanese soldiers. So I really like that scene.
I like the one where there's someone is like dying in the camp and he has to help do CPR. And like, it's one of the freakiest things I've ever seen where he's doing it and she's just dead. Like you can see that she's cold. And, but like he jerks her so much trying to like revive her that her eyes just kind of pop and look at him. It terrifies me. Like I remember that months after I see the movie every time.
Oh, and I think this movie is a lot about its smaller moments because there really isn't very much dialogue for large chunks of the movie. It's really just following Jim and his perspective. And there is a scene at the end of the movie where Jim is, he's pretty much dead and he's walking up. Where is he walking at the end? I can never remember.
The camp is kind of, the Japanese have to abandon the camp because they're starving and all that. I think everyone in the camp tries to march north to where they think there's food. And eventually, like, Jim just realizes that they're going to die. So he doubles back and goes back to the camp. I think
yeah.
at the end, he's going back to the camp.
Well, when he's either going to the camp or leaving it, the bomb goes off and he sees the flash and he's like, God's taking a picture. And I was just like, wow.
And it's also like right as it happens, like the woman Miranda Richardson plays, like she was in the camp, like, and she dies. And yeah, he sees and he like he thinks it's her soul or whatever going to heaven.
Yeah.
And it's like it's such a unique and like brilliant way to phrase the Nagasaki bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, every like you know it's technically hundreds of thousands of souls going somewhere. Like it's just you know all that death, and he thinks it's this transcendent moment.
Oh, what I just realized too is that's at the end of the film, but at the beginning he's talking to his mother. Who Miranda Richardson plays his mother figure in the end of the movie, but at the beginning he's actually talking to his mom and they're talking about God, but in a very childish way at that point. He's talking about having a tennis match with God.
Oh yeah.
Right.
I just realized that. That's like you can really see how far he's gone and just like how broken he is just with that one contrast. This movie's awesome.
This movie is awesome.
It might be my favorite Steven Spielberg film. I think it does a better job of like being dark and really just terrifying than Schindler's List. Like I prefer to Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is like it's such an original take on it, I think, because he's trying to survive, but while at the same time he's being pulled everywhere, and you don't really have that perspective with World War II movies. It's really about like triumphing over the opponent for World War II movies usually.
And I think that's especially true because he doesn't really have a home. Because, like, I mean, he is British, but he's never seen England. Like, he's never been there. He was born in Shanghai. He's
yeah.
never been anywhere.
And it's one of my favorite, like, lines in the entire movie when the doctor's like, remember, we're British. And he's like, yeah, but I've never been there.
Because it's like World War II was the last war. It was very clearly this side versus that side. You know, it was clearly United States, Britain, all that versus Japan, Germany. And here's a kid who doesn't have that. He's just there, and he has nowhere to go. And it's kind of like in Apocalypse Now, the longer version, where they ride up on the French plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these people who have just grown up there. I mean, it's still French Indochina to them, and they can't go back to France because they don't have anything there. But, if they stay in Vietnam, they're going to be killed. That's essentially what his position is.
It kind of suggests at the beginning that he's already compromised in his loyalty. But, you know, again, still in a childish way because he loves airplanes, and it just so happens that he thinks the Japanese built the best airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So one his favorite model and the toy he carries with him for the rest of the movie is just a little tin Japanese airplane. And when he sees the airplane pilots at the camp, he salutes them often. He becomes friends, sort of, with one of them, which, of course, becomes interesting near the end of the movie.
Yeah, because really the Japanese boy and Jim are growing up in very different circumstances, but just like on opposite sides of like a wire fence. And the Japanese boy, he's learning to become a a pilot, and that's pretty much Jim's dream. I know, it's just really sad, this movie. I just watched it.
It is really sad. I just keep thinking there are these beautiful moments that happen in it, like what Sasha was saying before, these smaller moments. And the one I'm thinking about now is when I think Jim first arrives at the camp, and this is the first time he's seen, since the camp is designed to be a working camp or work camp in order to build an airplane runway.
Mm-hmm.
He sees a plane being built for the first time, and the way it's shot is fantastic. How he walks up to it, and there are sparks flying everywhere because they're welding, and he hugs the plane, and mm-hmm. he, like, strokes it. And he, I think, is about to be shot by the Japanese sergeant, but because 3 or 4 Japanese airmen come up and see him, and they kind of already understand that he's doing it because he loves the airplanes and because he's a kid. And then the next shot is him in, a Japanese airman's leather jacket, and it's years later, near the end of the war, in the camp. And he's already...
I never made that connection before, that right. It's the pilot's jacket.
I just assume because it looks like a pilot's jacket and it has Japanese on the back, so
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing. And then again, with the juxtaposition between Jim in the camp, he's kind of the mascot for the Americans in the camp, but he helps out a lot around the British areas, like in the hospital and
mm-hmm.
around the dorm. The boy who's raised amongst the Japanese pilots is sort of the mascot for them because, you know, you just see him playing with a paper airplane or, you know, a toy airplane for a while, and then the next scene is him, I think the next scene you see him in, he's playing with the airplane, but he's walking up to the airmen and they're all, like, rubbing his head and
yeah.
just sort of treating him as a kid, even though, you know, it's assumed that he's there to become a pilot later on. I mean, to be honest, I saw this kid and I was a little confused with his role at first because I didn't really get why a teenager would just be in a Chinese...
Yeah, he's just, like, running around the place with a toy plane, and it's clearly, like, a makeshift military base. And he's the only teenager on that side.
Right. Like, where did he come from? Is he the sergeant's kid or what?
Yeah,
but oh, and the fact that Jim is able to basically pull anything from the sergeant as long as he apologizes. And that's what also tends to happen in the camp is Jim, I think, it seems like Jim's the only one who learns Japanese while he's there. So he's the one who knows that, like, in order to get the chaos is stopped because there is a riot that happens as retribution for the Americans bombing Shanghai. He's the one who breaks a window before the sergeant breaks the window and then bows in front of him and says, you know, something in Japanese. That's the other thing. None of the foreign languages here are translated. So it's kind of hard, but it seems like he's saying, you know, you don't need to do this to the hospital. And he's bowing, a very deep bow. And I don't know, just that's such a big role for such a little kid, and it seems like the Americans and the British adults are going to be too proud to bother doing that and are more likely to fight back in that situation. I have a feeling we should talk about the John Malkovich character a bit, if anyone wants to start off about him.
Jake?
I mean, it's so tailor-made for John Malkovich. It's just it's just like a snake oil salesman. The man is one of the worst human beings, but he's also not in a... you know, like every Spielberg film is kind of linked in some way to some sort of children's either novel or film, and this is obviously a bit of Oliver Twist, and obviously, Malkovich is kind of the Fagin character. They organize... You know, he organizes all this kind of black market trade in the camp, but at the same time, it's someone like Jim who does all the heavy lifting. Because, like, I mean, Jim is the one like you said, he's the one who's least proud compared to the adults, but at the same time, he's also kind of the most resilient. He doesn't let anything faze him anymore.
Yeah, we try to talk about John Malkovich, and we
keep
going back to Chris because he's so great in this.
That's how, I mean, because that's the amazing thing, that someone like John Malkovich is essentially playing off Christian Bale.
Yeah. No. Sorry, I just remembered when we were talking to John Malkovich. When Jim actually gets to stay in the American cabin, or whatever it would be, and all the American soldiers are saluting him, and then he talks to Frank in an American accent. I laughed so hard at that the first time. It's great.
Oh, and he's already adopted a lot of American culture. Like, he has the Life magazines as part of the black market stuff. The things, he ends up with just one suitcase, and that's what he carries from, like, one place to the next, pretty much. And he always tacks up that Norman Rockwell picture of the parents taking care of the sick kid. And of course, that's because his parents aren't with him, but just that it's so American, and he's really able to switch his allegiances over to the Americans pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's really interesting to me, at least, the fact that he's so flexible, and it's just doing whatever he can to survive.
At the beginning of the movie, one of my favorite scenes is after they come out of Amherst Avenue, where Jim and his parents live. All the opening scenes are in houses, very rich. You don't see more people than Jim and his parents and a few of the servants. And then there's a cut scene to Shanghai, and there's thousands upon thousands of people just roaming the streets. And Jim and his parents are dressed up in very elaborate costumes for a party. I love the moment when they're showing all of the English citizens in all of the different cars, and they all have different, really exaggerated costumes on, and that's contrasted with all the Chinese people just fighting in the streets to get food and to get where they're going. It just shows how sheltered and secluded Jim is at the beginning, and that changed by the end, where at the end, you see his parents are still dressed like they were at the beginning of the movie. If you guys felt the same, but I completely hated the parents at the end, even though I know they couldn't do anything. But the fact that they were still all dressed proper and seemed to have not been fazed very much, except for with the loss of their son, and Jim's, like, completely destroyed.
That might be my favorite aspect of the film, the way that, like, there's so much kind of light surrealism in it. You know, if there's all this, you know, late in the film when they leave the camp, all these formerly rich English people stumble into this, like, kind of clearing where it's just, there's just Rolls Royces and pianos and gold,
yeah,
all this crap that would, you know, you could buy a small country with everything in that little meadow. And now they just don't get, they're just frantically looking for water. Like, it's such a brilliant moment. And stuff like the, when they have to drive through just throngs of people desperate to get out of Shanghai before the bombs fall, and just like, oh, the party's, we're going to be late for the party. And it might be my favorite thing about the film, besides Christian Bale.
And then, not really juxtaposed, but related to that, when he's first left alone in the house, when he gets separated from his mother, just shouts, "Be at the house, we'll meet you there." And he spends days in this mansion, and he can't think of anything to do besides eat when he's hungry and ride his bicycle in the house. And then later on at the camp, when he comes back to the camp, the Americans have dropped down, I guess, food packages. He's doing the same thing, except this time he doesn't have to worry about when the food's running out as much as he did before, and he's just riding his bike until he comes across the American soldiers.
Speaking of the house, like, there's that awesome scene where he goes into his parents' bedroom, and, like, when they were frantically kind of throwing stuff in a suitcase, like, I guess they broke something with sand in it.
Oh,
and
the
you
mother's
can, like, see
powder.
All their footprints and, like, handprints in it, and it's just, like, it's this horrifying, it just looks like there was a struggle, and like it freaks him out too. Like he has to throw open a window and like blow the sand away. And that's just, that's such an, like, anyone who says that Spielberg is kind of like a, you know, kind of a hack, and people do, like, watch this movie, honestly.
I'm surprised at how many people have not seen this movie. I talk about this movie a lot, and usually there's a look of just no recognition on the other person's face.
I will say this right now, I have only heard maybe the title of this movie. It was in film class last semester where we played a clip. It was actually the clip of the car going through the throngs of people in Shanghai at the beginning, mm-hmm. when I actually saw anything of it. Although it was funny, my teacher presented it as like, yeah, this is that movie you've all grown up on, and it's young Christian Bale, whatever. And then he put on the clip.
And it was probably like, what? What is this?
It was basically me mentally noting to myself, okay, I should probably see this movie, shouldn't I?
Yeah. Jake, you've seen this movie before. We've talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
When did you see it for the first time?
I was in, it was a, actually a history class in middle school, I think, or I was in eighth grade, and I had never heard of it. Like, and I was a big Spielberg fan because, you know, he's one of the few, like, big-time directors you know even as, like, a kid. And I had just never heard of it, and I didn't, and I think Christian Bale had only just then kind of started to rise up, because, I mean, I was 12, I hadn't seen American Psycho, so, and I didn't, and I liked it, but I guess I wasn't paying attention, just because it was like, you know, it was kind of an excuse to nap in class, but I went back and saw it again, maybe 2 years ago, and I was, and it just instantly became, like, my favorite Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah, one of my, favorite anecdotes about Christian Bale is related to this movie. He was doing press junkets in Paris during the press for this film, and he had done so many interviews, and Christian Bale is notorious for hating the industry, even at 12. And he had been doing so many interviews, and in this one particular, he had an orange in his hand, and he started stabbing it with a pencil for the entire interview, like aggressively stabbing the orange with a pencil. And then he stopped the interview and ran away for the remainder of the day, and they couldn't find him. I find that little anecdote just sums up the entire personality of Christian Bale.
Even at 12, this
even
is how
at
he
12.
Was.
Even at 12, he's just like preparing to start. Like he's already on the path to just screaming at people.
Yeah, no, I think that's second to my other favorite Christian Bale anecdote, where you know the business card scene in American Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Apparently, he sweated on cue for every take. At the same time, he just started sweating. Like he could control his skin and his glands.
I'm yeah. not sure whether to be impressed or slightly scared.
Yeah, but apparently the entire crew was just like completely flabbergasted and slightly terrified. Maybe some other child actors now, not just the love-in of Christian Bale.
Sounds good. Jake, do you want to give your recommendation first?
Yeah, my film is another Steven Spielberg film. It's AI. It was made, I think, in 2001, based on a script that Stanley Kubrick had come up with, but he handed it off to Spielberg before he died. And it's basically a science fiction film where global warming is kind of, and the natural disasters that follow from it have kind of destroyed most of Earth. Like, the human population is way down. There's very few resources, so basically the people that are who are left use robots to do a lot of their chores. This one scientist, for whatever reason, while it becomes clear later, he tries to find sort of the robot's soul. So he makes this child robot to kind of give to families, either as a way to prepare them for a child or to make up for not having one. And this couple whose child has some really rare disease and they have to put them in some sort of, like, cryogenic freeze, they're so devastated that the father who works for the same company that the scientist develops for uses them as sort of a test case. So he sends home this kid robot that they call David. And at first the mom is just freaked out, as you would be, like, here's like a child toy for you. And so she won't like deal with it, but it ends up being human enough that she kind of warms up to it until the actual son gets better. And he comes back home and he resents the fact that basically his parents replaced him with an expensive toy. The kid acts like David wants to kill him or something. Like, it's a weird, his friends tease the robot, and because it's programmed to be a child, it gets scared and it kind of like grabs on to his quote unquote brother and sinks him into a pool. So the parents end up getting rid of him, and the whole movie is about this kid robot trying to find his mother again, or what he thinks is his mother. And it ends up, I mean, the plot-wise, it's kind of simple, even though it goes through all these sort of vignettes, but it's mainly about what makes us human, like that kind of Blade Runner-type theme. Mm-hmm. You know, is there what separates robot from human? And Haley Joel Osment is the kid who plays David. And it's one of the most, like, perversely kind of mean-spirited yet amazing casting decisions ever, because it pretty much plays on the fact that Haley Joel Osment is, like, cute to the point of being creepy. So, like, I mean, pretty much the way that the family deals with David is the way I deal with Haley Joel Osment, where, like, you're like, oh, look at this cute kid, he's kind of cool. And then, like, after that, you're like, okay, can you, like, blink or something?
Yeah, they really couldn't cast anybody else at that point in time, could they?
I don't think so, and I don't know. A, he'd come off the Sixth Sense, and he was one of the few children you could actually bank a movie on. Mm-hmm. And B, I don't know anyone who could just fit that role. I mean, he fits it so perfectly, because he basically, I mean, again, it's kind of the way that they use Natalie Portman in Black Swan, where she's just so kind of stiff that she works to the role.
Right.
So it's like, so Haley Joel Osment, he's not a terrible child actor. I'm not a big fan of child actors overall, so he's definitely not on my, like, low end of people I hate. That's a mean thing to say about children, but he's used so well in this movie, and he ends up being really surprisingly effective. He can be really emotional, but at the same time, he has to play somewhat off reality. And I can't pinpoint exactly what he does, because that's such a complicated thing to do. But I don't, he just nails that part.
I didn't know it was a Kubrick script. Like, that's new information for me.
Well, he and someone else, I can't really see the name somewhere. He and someone else did kind of a spec script, and also, but he did a bunch of sketches for it. Kubrick did so much research for everything, or he would do so many sketches.
Right.
Something like, you know, Napoleon, which he never made, apparently it has just thousands of pages of research. I mean, it would be a librarian's dream to just go through his book of research for Napoleon. And for this, it's just a bunch of sketches, some of which I think were used, but a lot of it, I believe Spielberg kind of changed around. But it ends up, because it mixes maybe the two least likely people to ever be mixed. You know, you've got Kubrick on one end, who's very cold, satirical, intellectual, and you have Steven Spielberg, who's the most popular director of all time. He just knows, play to an audience. And they fit together in such an interesting way, because they've said over and over through the years that everything you think is a Kubrick edition, everything that's dark and scary and really just kind of terrifying is something that Spielberg put in, and everything that's actually hopeful or optimistic is Kubrick's work.
I haven't seen the movie in a very long time, but I remember when they're in, like, some kind of landfill, I just remember being completely terrified at that moment. I don't know if they're in the landfill for a very long time or if it's just one scene, but do you know what I'm talking about? Making it up.
I mean, it kind of goes through stuff like that. There's that one part where they get captured by this sort of Luddite society, you know, all these like anti-robot people.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm talking about.
And it's like this weird, like, redneck thing. It's like, it's just a bunch of, like, there's rock and roll there for some reason, like Southern rock, and they're just destroying robots on stage. Because it's kind of, I mean, like I said earlier about Empire of the Sun, that every Spielberg film kind of ties into some kind of children's work. And this one is very much Pinocchio. Like, it's, and Pinocchio has kind of been in a lot of Spielberg films. It's referenced in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But this one, there's...
Pinocchio is, like, the most terrifying Disney movie ever made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The donkey scene? Oh, my God. It's terrifying. And the whale scene.
Oh my God, the whale
let's not talk about Pinocchio.
I was thinking about Spielberg movies for a while, but I ended up going with Now and Then, which is like taking a complete left turn from Spielberg, especially from Empire of the Sun. But I do have a runner-up, and it's partially a runner-up because I've forgot to look up how old the actor was for this, but Europa Europa is another World War II story that's coming of age, and it's really good. It's a German production, and it's actually based on a true story about a guy who I believe he's Jewish, and I can't remember if it's like the night before his bar mitzvah is when some of the riots start happening in his town. And so his parents decide to move to Poland, but of course he gets separated from his family. In a weird string of events, he winds up in a Russian orphanage. And then in another weird string of events, he's captured by the Germans. Keep in mind, he's a German Jew who just happened to be found in amongst Russians. So he's bilingual by now. He switches, and they think of him as a hero, I think, because he was captured alongside Stalin's son. So he's taken to a German youth academy and kind of becomes like the hero of the academy. So he has to constantly hide he's Jewish while there. And it's just really fascinating. It's really good. Europa, Europa, check it out. But it's my runner-up. Sorry, but my childhood memories usually override my quality of movie choices, especially for recommendations, and I love Now and Then. And I've always loved Now and Then.
I've seen it.
Yay. I think that's more than most guys can say, actually. Not to put down men or anything, but it is a really girly movie. Even the blurb on the cover is the best coming-of-age movie since Stand By Me, and on the Wikipedia page, it's like known as the female version of Stand By Me.
I could see that comparison.
Yeah, I see it through the narration, but the fact that they're all friends and have relatively healthy careers at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Without the frame narrative, I could see that comparison.
Right. So it's about four friends who came of age in 1970, kind of during this one summer, and it has a frame narrative through Samantha, who, as an adult, is played by Demi Moore. And they made a pact when they were 12 to always come back home if any of them need them. And Chrissy is about to give birth, so she calls them all back. Samantha is now a science fiction writer who is really distanced from home. Teeny is now a famous movie star. Roberta is the doctor in town who lives in Sin with her boyfriend. And of course, Chrissy is happily married and about to give birth. And as they're reminiscing about this one summer, it's all from Samantha's perspective. The child actresses are Christina Ricci, who plays the young Roberta, Thora Birch, who plays Teeny, Gabby Hoffman, who plays, I believe she plays Samantha, and then Chrissy, who's played by Ashley Aston Moore. And basically, in the summer of 1970, they are really interested in seances, and they're also trying to save money save up money to buy a tree house so that they can have independence from their families. And during that, Samantha's parents are getting a divorce. Teenie is just accepting the fact that she can't trust her parents. Chrissy's learning about sex for the first time, and Roberta is kind of, she's always been a tomboy because her mother died when she was 4, and she does things like tape down her breasts and is just sort of having to accept that, like, as she's getting older, she's going to have to, like, change how she acts, I guess.
Isn't the guy from Casper her love interest? What's that guy's name?
Oh shit, I don't know his name.
It's like Devon Sawa or something like that. I think I might be thinking of a wrong person, but
No,
I'm gonna look it up while you speak.
okay, I think that's him actually. And it's just really cool. I guess I like the frame narratives. We were talking about this over email a while ago as an possible theme in the future. And the fact that, I watched this as a kid. And the seance aspect's really cool. They think they've resurrected Dear Johnny, who died in 1945, but he was their same age, so you get that little bit of connection. And the movie bounces between these light-hearted moments, but then these almost surprisingly dark moments where their town seems so safe, but when they find out that Johnny died by murder, they have to kind of come to terms that the outside world is there and they can't always pretend that it's not. And they run into a hippie at one point, played by Brendan Fraser, who like gives them their first cigarettes and tells them, you can't
That
trust your
was
parents.
Brendan Fraser?
Yeah, that was Brendan
I
Fraser.
totally forgot about that. Oh my God. Okay, continue. Sorry, I'm full, like, flabbergasted over here.
That's okay. It's these sort of stuck in the 1970s kind of plot lines that make it really nostalgic, plus really kicking soundtrack. Then you also have things that, as like a kid from the 90s, it or kind of universally you have to deal with it. I think everyone has to come with to terms with you will probably not grow up to share the same morals as your parents, or the same world viewpoints as your parents. A lot of kids will go through divorce. We all have to face death at some point. With Roberta, and even with the overarching trying to figure out the mystery of Johnny and doing the seances, all of the characters come to terms with like death and how people react to death. Roberta fakes her death at a lot of, they kind of mentioned she jumped off the roof a few months before, but then she pretends she drowned in one scene. You mostly stay with the child actresses or actors, and they just give pretty, they give good, strong performances, I think, as one. They act really realistically as like a tight-knit group of friends.
No,
And
I completely agree with that. I don't know who was in it. I think it might have been Teenie and maybe Samantha, but they're going to the cemetery to do something about Dear Johnny, and Teenie goes down the sewer.
oh, it was Samantha tells Teenie that her parents are getting divorced and they are trying out the treehouse, which it's supposed to be in one of their backyards, but I don't think they bought it yet. And when they're walking back to their neighborhood, Samantha loses the bracelet Teenie just gave her and she goes into the sewer to get it. That movie, or no, that scene freaked me out as a kid.
That scene is just, it's gut-wrenching. I remember that scene. Like, that's probably one of the scenes in the movie that I remember. It's just, it's horrible. It's sad. It's scary.
Terrifying, especially because you don't think of storm drains as being dangerous. And of course, I think storm drains now are designed not to have a huge gaping hole in them, like how it is here. But also, just from Teenie's perspective, she can't do anything for Samantha. It's not really within her power. She can't lift the manhole cover. Even if she jumped down to get her, she probably wouldn't be able to fight the current. And it's shot so dark and so cramped, and there are rats. Ugh, that scene is freaky. I mean, it's great because it's, effective, obviously, but it's scary.
Jake, do you have any positive memories of Now and Then?
I think you guys misheard me. I said I hadn't seen it.
Oh, you
Oh,
hadn't?
I'm okay.
Sorry.
But honestly, it sounds really interesting, and this is a solid cast list. I had never heard of it, but I gotta watch this now.
I think you really had to be a girl in the 90s to even hear about this movie.
Yeah, it's a very girl-centric movie. I mean, I kind of don't want to say that, but it's true. Especially because it's geared to like girls at a certain age. But yeah, Now and Then. It's fun, I guess. It's mostly fun.
Yeah, we say it's like gut-wrenching and terrifying, but it's actually very lighthearted and funny.
And there's a birthing scene, and they talk about booze and stuff and fake boobs. It's exciting. Trust us. Okay, so Sasha?
I also have a runner-up, like Allison. My runner-up is Freddie Highmore in Finding Neverland. Have either of you seen that movie? Yeah.
Yes.
So the reason why he gets the runner-up position is because of the scene where he's putting on the play that he wrote. Just his temper tantrum on stage was heartbreaking. And I really wanted to talk about Finding Neverland, but I've got a better movie to talk about. So my choice is the 1994 movie Leon the Professional. You both have seen it, right?
Yeah.
Of course you have. It stars, is it Jean Reno?
Jean Reno.
Yeah. See, I go for Allison with all the accents. She can do the Japanese and the French, and I'll just say it all butchered. So he's a hitman named Leon, and it also stars Natalie Portman in her feature film debut as Matilda. And the basic plot for the movie is Leon and Matilda, they live in the same apartment building, and he meets her, I think, when he comes back from grocery shopping. It's not important, but he meets her on the staircase, and she's about 12 years old, and she's sporting a black eye, and she's smoking a cigarette. And he talks to her, and she's very flippant and much older than her actual age. She's acting like she's in her 40s. They just have that one encounter, and then later, Matilda's family is actually murdered by some corrupt drug enforcement officers who are led by Gary Oldman, who is terrifying as he always is. So when Matilda comes home and she realizes her family has been murdered, she, instead of going to her apartment where she'll probably be killed with the rest of her family, she walks to Leon's apartment, his door, and she asks to be let in so they don't realize that she's part of the murdered family. And reluctantly, he lets her in, and she lives with him for a while. And eventually, she convinces him to teach her how to be an assassin. And it's quite funny. There are some very, very well-loved scenes in this movie. You probably have seen them on YouTube, particularly the scene where Natalie Portman's laughing in the restaurant ridiculously, and the scene where she plays dress up as Madonna.
Such a good movie. I don't think Natalie Portman, between this and Beautiful Girls, which she made, I believe, the year after, like, she's flat out the best child actor I think ever, maybe. And I don't think, like, it took her until Black Swan even come close to either of them.
No, I completely agree. The only movie in between that I really, really love is The Phantom Menace, but I know that's like a controversial statement.
So controversial.
Yeah, I know you guys aren't even going to say anything. But yeah, Leon the Professional is pretty much the best movie she's ever been in. And it's actually cool that we're talking about Christian Bale and Natalie Portman in the same podcast who've just won Oscars.
Oh, yeah.
Time.
Yeah, man. Whereas they both really should have gotten their Oscars for the first movies they made.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I was so jealous when you picked The Professional, or Leon, it's known as both. And sometimes Leon The Professional.
Yeah.
Tangent over. But I was so jealous when you picked that because it's so good. You know, Gary Oldman is absolutely terrifying in it. I picked
up. He's one scary man.
He's one scary man.
He's also like the most hilarious scary man ever.
Yeah. And he's weirdly quotable in this movie. Like, do you like Beethoven?
Oh my god, whenever someone just says the word everyone now, I think of this movie.
Oh god. No, I remember, I saw this movie. I don't remember. I think this movie came out in 94, but I didn't see it for a while, and I think I might have been around 12 years old when I saw this movie, and I didn't pick out the movie, obviously, but I think I walked in on my parents or my sister watching the movie, and from that moment on, I wanted that bob that she has on. I wanted her haircut, and I have curly hair, so I couldn't pull it off. So I walked around with pretty much an afro for like a year.
Yeah. Aww.
Yeah.
Is that before you had your first hair straightener?
Oh god, we're talking about really girly things now. No, I look retarded with straight hair, so I just keep curly hair.
Awesome. I actually prefer curly hair. I have curly hair as well. But like my mom has tried to force straightening my hair on me before.
Jake, do you use a flat iron?
Girlfriend, not for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't know, just the relationship that Matilda builds with Leon, as much as it seems like she's just going to him because he's like the only neighbor she knows.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's her key to revenge. And what I thought was so interesting was she has an abusive family life. She doesn't really want revenge for her entire family. She wants it just for her little brother.
Yeah.
Because she's like, he didn't deserve to die. Her dad is a drug dealer, so it's almost like she understands her dad was and her dad beat her, so she understands like he probably got what he deserved. Mm-hmm. But my brother did not. He was innocent. And I'm not sure if that's really what convinces Leon to teach her how to be a cleaner professional, but I just remember that moment being like, okay, this is going to be interesting when I first saw it, which I think I was like 14 or something. Interspersed with training, you get these little smaller moments where like he talks about the plant that he loves.
Sorry.
I know.
The plant is hilarious and endearing.
It's cute. I love the plant. And then the restaurant scene where she cons him into letting her drink like a bit of champagne. And I think he buys her a dress at one moment. And I don't know, it's a cute relationship. I think a lot of people see it and kind of jump to conclusions about it, but to me it always seemed like Leon had to be so distant from people. This is the first chance he ever gets to be close to someone. And he sort of adopts her. Final thoughts or other child performances that stick to our minds?
There's a Chaplin film called The Kid. I can't remember the name of the kid in it, but I mean, obviously, it's an old film. It's a silent, but the kid's name is Jackie Coogan. He's as like funny and as interesting as Chaplin in that movie. And it's one of Chaplin's best movies.
Yeah, I think Frankly, My Dear was talking about that on an older podcast. They were talking about the kid and how, like, Chaplin was able to get, like, such a great performance from him. I mean, they're mostly, yeah, talking about movie dads, I think. But, yeah, and doesn't the kid kind of really the mark against, I guess, or the meter against how we should judge everything else, at least for child performances?
I think it might have, yeah, I think it is, like, the first big-time child role, because obviously there wasn't television in 1921, so there wasn't any, like, Leave It to Beaver type thing. I think it was, like, the first major child star.
Oh, I thought of a movie with child actors. Their performances aren't, like, remarkable or anything, but it's an enjoyable movie. It's Son of Rambo. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen it yet, but I've been meaning to.
Jake?
I liked it. I wasn't as crazy about it as some of my friends, but I thought the kids in it did a really great job.
Mm-hmm. Well, for Allison, it's about these two kids, but they are opposites, but they become friends, and they start making a movie, and it's just the most sweet movie about friendship between two young boys, and there's so many references to all the movies, and it's quite sweet, and you should probably watch it. I think you'd probably enjoy it.
Yeah, I've been meaning to watch it. I'll up it. I'll put it close to the top of my Netflix queue. I can't think of anything specifically, right, or anything specific right now, but I'm just going to go back to anything Spielberg. He's done a lot of kid-oriented movies, too, like maybe earlier on in his career, but he did The Goonies, right? I'm not making shit up here.
He produced it.
He's able to get involved with these things. I think he produced or was one of the executive producers for, like, a cartoon in the 90s, Tiny Toons.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. I just remember they did a little caricature of him in one episode. As, like, just a guy who plays video games all day. I don't know. Sasha, did you ever watch that?
What?
Tiny Toons?
No, I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's basically Looney Tunes, but with different characters and kind of hyped up for the 80s or 90s.
Huh.
Wasn't it, like, child versions of, like, Bugs and Daffy and stuff?
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
It's like they're all like baby versions or something. I never watched it, but I think I saw like the commercials or whatever for it.
And then I think Hook, right? He was involved in that. I feel lame for not being able to look this up, but my keyboard's really loud.
Yeah, he made it.
Yeah, right. And apparently that movie gets a lot of crap, but it was another one of those movies that I always liked as a kid. And
Hook is back one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, and looking back on it, the child performances are just really good.
Yeah.
And it's
got Rufio.
Yes. And Dustin Hoffman plays Hook.
That might be the only Dustin Hoffman movie performance I just really love. Like, he's such a good Hook. He was so perfect for that role, and he has such fun with it.
Oh, and that was another movie that, like, freaked me out at the end of it, because he's eaten by the crocodile clock, or the alligator clock.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, as a kid, that just freaked me out, because I didn't know what happened to him.
Well, it also makes no sense, because doesn't the open mouth, like, fall on him? So
it's like a stuffed crocodile, so he's just kind of...
So is he suffocated, or what happened? Yeah, these are things that I wanted to know, like, as
a
kid.
But everybody's cheering, so apparently he's dead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And things like the food fight with the imaginary food. Mm. I actually really like Robin Williams having to learn to be Peter Pan again. And the performances from the kids in that movie, as, like, the children who are in Neverland, but also, like, Peter Pan's children, like, they give really good performances, too, and it's, I don't know, it's a fun movie. So, this is, like, my second
runner-up,
I guess. And it's another one
from... Lots of interrupts.
Yeah, we've got a lot of movies for you listeners. You should check them out.
Yeah, but first, Empire of the Sun.
Yeah.
Because it's not, our opinion of the movie is not affected by love from the 90s or whatever.
Or nostalgia.
Nostalgia.
Because it's like, I think it was made before any of us were born. So, and plus, it's just like, it's a film that most people don't know about. So it's not like any, people didn't grow up on it. I've never met anyone who grew up on Empire of the Sun.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess partly because it's so scary.
Mm-hmm.
But in, you know, a realistic way, whereas Hook, it's, like, pretend scary, of course.
Oh, there's that moment in Hook where, like, they throw that dude in the box and throw scorpions in it. That is the scariest thing ever. I just thought about that because my nightmares tonight.
Oh, my gosh.
The boo box where they just, like, throw in scorpions. And I think the person they throw in, even though it's a male, sailor or pirate, I think it's meant to be Glenn Close.
What?
That's what the Wikipedia says, because I watched it recently, because I've been going through Spielberg's movies, and I think that's what it said, and I was like, there's just no way.
That's crazy, and I must have repressed that or something, because I don't remember the scorpion box.
Well, you're lucky, because it's the most horrifying thing of all
time.
Well,
you're lucky.
But okay. I even watched Hook recently. All right. Anyway.
Allison, do a summary or something.
Do a summary?
Make this podcast awesome.
This podcast is awesome, listeners. You should probably be aware of that by now. We are on episode 10. I'm just going to reiterate this one more time. Everyone should check out Empire of the Sun. It's really good, and it's proof that Christian Bale was born to be an actor. Okay. And actually, before I sign off, I just want to say thank you, Jake, for filling in for us and being such an awesome guest and an awesome feedbacker.
We really, really appreciate it.
This is easily my favorite podcast. I mean, well, now that Ricky Gervais doesn't do it anymore, but it's a pretty good competition, you guys.
We're second to only Ricky Gervais. That's pretty great praise.
I mean,
I'm surprised we haven't really talked about Ricky Gervais. Like, I mentioned David Brent once.
I know. You said that, you know, you'd pick David Brent because you might be able to somehow snag Martin Freeman. I just thought about Carl, and I got so happy.
Allison, have you listened to any of the radio shows?
I haven't, but I've seen you guys go back and forth on Twitter about it.
Yeah, so Jake sent me the website that kind of houses all the radio shows because they're really not available anywhere. And I've become obsessed. I think I've listened to 11 of their shows, maybe 12 in a couple of days, and they're all like an hour long.
Huh.
Yeah, I'm obsessed. And I think I'm in love with Stephen Merchant. I'm pretty sure.
Stephen Merchant is like the dark horse of them. Like, I'm such a huge fan of Stephen Merchant, and because Ricky just tries to like get Carl to say things, and Carl's just Carl, but Stephen, everything he says is just perfect.
Because Carl now has like all of his fame from like The Idiot Abroad and his books, and then of course Ricky is the star of their shows, but I have no idea how Stephen Merchant is not ridiculously famous. He is, you're right, like the dark horse of the group, and he's so much more eloquent and funny, I find, but I don't know, his time will come. Oh, have either of you seen Hall Pass? Apparently he's in it.
No. He might be the only reason I would ever consider seeing it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's actually out. I know there's some advanced screening.
It just came out.
Yeah,
either it came out last week or I think it's going to come out tomorrow.
Have either of you seen The Tooth Fairy?
No.
Apparently he's in that.
What?
Yeah.
There are limits to my love.
Apparently, Stephen Merchant plays a tooth fairy, or just like a fairy that is like an accountant or something, and he doesn't have his wings. So The Rock, or whatever his name is, he teaches him how to become a tooth fairy. I've never seen it, but my friend was explaining the movie to me.
I'll check out the radio shows, because I'm intrigued, but I will not check out The Tooth Fairy. So now I'll sign off. I'm Allison from nerdvampire.wordpress.com.
I'm Sasha from the Final Girl Project.
And I'm Jake from Not Just Movies.
And this has been Some Cast It Hot. Thanks for listening.